Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Have you ever been in a situation, maybe something pretty simple, like a tiny fender bender in a parking lot, or maybe a package just disappears from your porch, and suddenly, boom, you're kind of thrown into this role of investigator. You need to figure out exactly what went down, who was there, what was said, what did you really see? It's amazing how fast something simple gets complex when you need, you know, specific, solid information. Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take a whole stack of information and boil it down to what you actually need to know. Today, we are diving deep into the really fascinating world of gathering information and reporting it. Specifically, how critical thinking and paying super close attention to detail become, well, the absolute foundation for effective investigations. We've got this great source here. It's a pretty comprehensive training handout for police officers. And our mission today is to unpack its key insights for you. Maybe you're just curious, or maybe you're prepping for something similar, or maybe you just want to understand how information gets built piece by piece in these really high-stakes situations.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating about this handout is just how incredibly structured it all is, how intentional the whole process has to be if you want reliable, accurate results. And like you said, this isn't just for law enforcement. It's basically a masterclass in observation, in asking questions, in communicating clearly. These are universal principles, really, for anyone who needs to gather facts, write things down accurately, and sort of, you know, separate the truth from all the noise. It really highlights how vital clarity and reliability are when the information really counts.
Okay, so let's jump right in. Right at the start, our source makes this really clear distinction between two key ideas that honestly might sound pretty similar to most people, interviewing and interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they both involve asking questions, right? So what's the fundamental difference there? And why is it so important to get that straight from the get-go?
That's a great place to start because it is foundational. The main difference really boils down to the primary purpose and crucially, who you're talking to. Think of an interview as more of a broad conversation aimed at gathering information. You're trying to get the whole picture, the perspective of someone who might be a complainant, that's the person reporting the incident, or maybe a witness who saw something, or a victim who experienced it. The main goal is just getting their perspective, often in their own words, with as little influence as possible. Interrogation, though, that's different. It's much more formal, it's targeted, and it often comes with a lot more legal strings attached. This is usually reserved for a suspect, someone you believe is connected to a crime directly or indirectly. Here, the goal shifts. You're not just gathering general info. You might be trying to get incriminating details, clear up inconsistencies, maybe even get a confession. And because of that, the legal side of things changes dramatically, especially around a person's rights. The training module really hammers this home. The goal is to recognize the components of and the differences between interviewing complainants, witnesses, victims, and suspects. Mm-hmm. It's not just words, it shapes the whole approach.
Right, that makes total sense. The stakes are obviously way higher when you're dealing with a suspect. So why is knowing this difference so critical right at the very start of any interaction? What happens if you get it wrong?
Well, getting it wrong can have big consequences. Knowing whether you're conducting an interview or an interrogation dictates your entire strategy legally and practically. It tells you what your legal obligations are like, for instance, when you absolutely have to give Miranda warnings. And it even affects the physical environment you set up. You wouldn't interview a really traumatized victim in the same way you'd question a suspect, right? It's all about respecting rights, staying ethical, and ultimately making sure you get the most accurate and legally solid information possible. Classifying it wrong could jeopardize the whole investigation or even violate someone's rights.
Okay, and even before you start asking those first questions, say you arrive on a scene, what's the source say is the immediate, almost gut instinct thing to do?
The first absolutely critical step is to separate the parties involved immediately. Imagine showing up to a scene, maybe there's been a fight, or even just a fender bender, and there are multiple people there, maybe agitated. The instinct might be to talk to them all together, but the training says, nope, don't do that. Conduct interviews individually and, really importantly, outside the hearing range of others. Part of that is about safety, sure. It ties into something called the contact and cover principle. One officer interviews, the other watches everyone else for safety. But the main reason for separating them is to make sure each person's statement truly reflects their own opinions and observations. When people are together, they can influence each other's memories, sometimes without even realizing it. Or worse, they might get their stories straight. Separating them lets the interviewer locate discrepancies and figure out what's valid. You want each person's raw, uninfluenced version of events.
Ah, so you're digging for those independent memories, trying to see what matches up without them hearing each other first.
Yeah, precisely. You want to see where the stories overlap naturally, those common threads. And if you do find differences after getting their individual accounts, then you have a chance to confront subject with any discrepancies and allow subject to explain or retract. It's not about accusing them right away, but more about clarifying things, refining the truth, understanding why their stories differ. Did they genuinely forget something or is something else going on? It's about peeling back those layers.
Okay, so that covers the immediate scene. What about when you need to do a more formal, maybe longer interview? Does the place you do it matter?
Oh, absolutely. The environment can be a huge factor. Right there on the scene, the focus is just getting the essential facts quickly and safely. But for those more in-depth interviews or maybe more sensitive ones, controlling the environment is key. The source is really specific here. You want no distractions. Think ringing phones, people walking past, background noise, get rid of it all. Comfortable lighting and temperature also matter. Helps the person relax and focus. And the ideal room. Small, but not cramped with minimal furnishings. Think about it psychologically. A quiet, controlled, comfortable space minimizes outside interference and lets the person concentrate. If someone's distracted or uncomfortable, the quality of the information they give you is going to suffer. So yeah, optimizing that interview space is a deliberate strategy for getting better information. It helps truth come out.
The source gives this brilliant little example, so concise.
Mm-hmm.
A woman just yelling, "He stole my bike." What does that raw emotional outburst tell us right away about the challenge of gathering information in the real world?
Ha! It tells us everything and nothing, doesn't it? It's pure emotion, it's a conclusion, it's a plea for help. But for anyone who needs to act on that, a police officer, maybe you trying to sort out a dispute, it has zero useful detail. It's the perfect example of why you can't just take someone's initial statement at face value. You have to ask those follow-up questions, the specific ones, without feeding them the answers. You've got to break it down systematically.
Okay, let's really dig into this scenario then.
Yeah.
The officer shows up, finds this woman, Mary Turner. She's clearly upset. First words out of her mouth are, "He stole my bike." How does a trained officer start turning that outburst, that one simple sentence, into something useful, something actionable? How do they build a real case from that?
Right. The source calls this the questioning progression. It shows exactly how you deconstruct that sentence, "He stole my bike." And it perfectly illustrates that core investigative framework. For every who, there's a what, where, when, why, and how.
Huh.
It's not just something to memorize. It's the actual step-by-step method to get from that raw emotion to the hard facts underneath.
Okay, let's start with HE. Mary says, "He stole my bike," and then maybe clarifies, "Oh, just some guy I met a few days ago."
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how in the world do you get from that some guy to this incredibly detailed description? Jason Smith, white male, about 35, 5'9", thin brown shoulder-length hair, no facial hair, missing front tooth, panther tattoo under the right shoulder, brown cap, tan jacket, jeans, work boots. That's a huge leap in detail.
It is a huge leap, and it comes from asking those systematic who questions patiently, meticulously. The officer in this example didn't just stop at Jason Smith. They pushed for the last name, the approximate age, a precise physical description, height, build, hair color, hair length, facial hair, then the clothing details, and crucially, those distinguishing marks, a missing tooth, a specific tattoo. That makes someone instantly more identifiable than just brown hair. Every single one of those details matters for identification, for a witness potentially picking him out later, for actually finding him. You're basically building a complete profile from almost nothing, one specific question at a time, turning a vague idea into a sharp picture.
Okay, moving on to stole. Legally, what does stole actually mean? And how does an officer confirm the bits and pieces of a theft based on what's initially just an emotional claim?
Good question. Stole implies theft, right? Which legally usually means taking property without permission with the intent to keep it permanently. So to confirm those elements, you have to ask very specific questions about permission. Did he ask to use it? Did you give him permission? Did he say anything when he took off with it? These questions get at the lack of consent. Then you need the time and place. When exactly did this happen? Where were you? How long has he been gone? These details help confirm that lack of consent, establish the timeline of the alleged theft, pin down the location, all crucial legal elements of the offense. You're moving methodically from her conclusion stole to the concrete facts that either back it up or maybe show something else happened, piece by careful piece.
And then, ma'am, wait, wait. Seems obvious it refers to Mary Turner, the woman who's upset. But what personal details do you need beyond just her name to really nail down her role and her connection to the bike?
Right. You need to fully identify the complainant. That means getting her full name, address, date of birth, and reliable contact info, everything that confirms who she is and lets you follow up. But then, and this is vital, you have to establish her legitimate ownership of the property. Do you actually own this bike? When did you get it? Where did you buy it?
Okay.
This confirms her legal standing as the victim and her rightful claim to the property. That's essential for the report and any court case later. Without confirming ownership, the whole theft accusation is shaky.
And finally, bike. Mary just says, my bike. But the officer ends up with this super specific description. A blue Schwinn mountain bike, trail ride model, serial number 92837564, bought for $25 2 weeks ago from Secondhand Sports. How do you pull that level of detail out for just an object?
Again, it's about asking a series of very targeted questions, this time specifically about the property itself. You ask, what's the make? The model? Is there a serial number? What color is it? What style mountain bike, road bike? How much did you pay for it? Are there any other identifying marks, any damage, stickers, attachments, anything unique about it? Think about the difference. A bike was stolen versus a blue 18-speed Schwinn trail ride mountain bike, serial number X, with a rip seat and a deep dive podcast sticker on the frame was stolen. See? These questions turn a generic bike into a specific, identifiable item, one that can be put into a database, maybe recovered, and used as solid evidence. You leave no stone unturned because specificity increases the chances of getting it back and making a case stick.
So when you look at that whole journey going from this raw outburst, he stole my bike, to this complete, detailed, actionable story, how does that really show the officer's skill? And what's the lesson in there for the rest of us?
It perfectly shows how the use of follow-up questions allowed the officer to obtain the information to be able to write a complete report. It's the absolute difference between just a distress call, someone yelling about a problem, and a potential criminal case built on solid, checkable facts. By systematically breaking down that first shout, the officer gathered everything needed, detailed suspect description, exact property description, the location, even the direction he went and when he was last seen. It's building order out of chaos and the universal lesson. I think it's huge. Whether you're trying to sort out a fight with a friend, figure out a work problem, or even just understand a news story, those initial emotional statements, the vague claims, they're always just the starting point. Real understanding and being able to act effectively only comes when you drill down systematically with precise questions. Turning that initial fuzziness into concrete, actionable details, it teaches us to be a bit skeptical of conclusions and super curious about the facts underneath. Don't just accept the headline, ask who, what, where, when, why, and how until you get the full picture.
Okay, so we've seen how you painstakingly piece together a clear picture from that initial chaos, like the stolen bike example. But that's sort of the ideal scenario, right? When the person is willing and able to give you the info. What about when someone's being cagey or evasive or maybe even trying to, you know, mislead you? This is where that investigator's toolkit really has to come out. It's more than just the basic who, what, where. It's about mastering the art of asking and maybe even more importantly, the art of listening. Our source breaks down questioning into five distinct types. Let's dig into these because they feel really essential for anyone trying to get good information.
Absolutely. These five types give you a really nuanced toolbox for handling pretty much any conversation where you need to draw out information. Knowing which tool to use when is a really key skill. First up, we have open-ended questions. These are the really broad ones, like, can you just tell me what happened, or simply, what happened? The source says they're effective when starting and throughout an interview. Why? Because they basically invite the person to talk freely in their own words without feeling boxed in. This lets them guide the story initially, which can often bring out details or connections you wouldn't have even thought to ask about. Plus, you can observe their non-verbals. It's about letting them lay out their narrative first.
Okay, and then building on that open narrative, you have the fact-finding questions.
Exactly. Once you've got that initial broad story, these are your precision tools. These are the questions that build the concrete skeleton of the situation. Your classic 5 W's and 1 H. What was his name exactly? Where does he actually live? When did he leave the house? Why do you think he did that? How did it go down? They target those specific pieces of information, filling in the gaps from the open-ended start. They move you from the general story to the specific verifiable details that make up the core of any report.
Next are direct questions. These seem pretty simple, but the source actually warns against using them too much.
That's right. Direct questions are the ones looking for a simple yes or no, like, did you hit him? Huh. The source says flat out to avoid them generally, because they can just shut down the conversation. Imagine trying to get a full story using only yes-no questions. You wouldn't get very far. But they do have a place. They can be useful for those who avoid to answer a question. Huh. If someone's dancing around an issue, a direct question can sometimes pin them down, force an answer, or maybe reveal a qualification in their denial. Like, no, I didn't hit him, I just pushed him, which is still useful information. The big caution, though, is no rapid fire or yes-no questions. Firing them off makes it feel like an aggressive interrogation, puts people on the defensive, and just makes them clam up.
Okay, so after direct questions, we get into something a bit more, maybe, subtle. Opinion-seeking questions.
Yeah, these are interesting questions like, so what do you really think about this guy? Or, if you were in my shoes, what would you believe here? These aren't really about getting hard facts. Their purpose is more about building rapport, getting a feel for the person, or gaining insight into their role and maybe their motivations. They can reveal perceptions, biases, emotional states, all crucial for understanding the why behind actions and how the person sees the whole situation. Knowing a witness really dislikes the suspect, for instance, gives context to their testimony. Doesn't automatically mean they're lying, but it's important context. It helps understand the human element.
And the last type, number 5, leading questions. These sound potentially problematic, maybe even a bit manipulative if you're not careful.
They definitely can be tricky, yeah. Leading questions are designed, as the source says, to suggest or lead one toward an answer or confession. Examples given are things like, so you mentioned you were angry, and hey, everyone makes mistakes when they're mad, right? Or maybe, do you think you might have, you know, done it, but maybe didn't mean to? They're powerful techniques. They can steer someone towards a specific answer, maybe help them save face while admitting something, but you have to use them really carefully, ethically. There's a real risk of tainting the information if the person feels pressured or if the question itself plants an idea they didn't have before. That makes the answer less reliable, especially legally. It's a very fine line between guiding the conversation and actually extracting the truth.
So it's clear it's not just what you ask. It sounds like how you listen, how you follow up is just as critical, maybe even more so. What are some ways to make sure you're really grasping what the person is trying to tell you?
Yeah.
Especially if they're talking fast or being vague or just struggling to find the words.
Oh, absolutely crucial. The source puts it perfectly. Listening to the answers you get is as important as the questions you ask. It's about active listening, not just waiting for your turn to talk again. If someone's rambling or being evasive or just seems overwhelmed, the advice is to use baby steps. Slow the whole thing down, break the issue into smaller, manageable chunks, and you have to use clarification questions, follow-up phrases that invite them to elaborate. The examples in the source are great and totally universal. Someone says, "When he said that, I got really scared." Don't just nod and move on. You follow up with, okay, tell me more about being scared. What specifically made you feel that way? Or if they say something vague like, my husband came home acting crazy, like, you have to ask, help me understand what you mean by acting crazy. What exactly was he doing? These follow-ups push past generalizations to get to the concrete, observable actions, the articulable facts that actually clarify the meaning. It's all about seeking precision and resisting the urge to just fill in the blanks yourself, because crazy can mean a thousand different things to different people.
Right, so you've honed your questioning skills. But what happens to all that information you're pulling in, especially in the heat of the moment? How do you lock down those fleeting details, those quick observations, before your memory starts playing tricks on you? This leads us to what you call the unsung heroes, the basic field note and the more formal statement. Why are these simple brief notations just so fundamentally important?
They really are the absolute bedrock of any reliable investigation. Field notes are described as brief notations of specific events and circumstances recorded while fresh in the officer's mind. And they literally form the basis for the report's accuracy. You just can't overstate how important they are. Think how fast details fade, especially under stress. These notes, taken right then or immediately after, they reduce the need to recontact parties involved. That saves a ton of time and hassle later. And even more critically, they provide greater accuracy relative to time, statements, and events than memory alone. Your memory is faulty. It fills gaps. It rearranges things. Field notes are like your external hard drive, capturing things precisely as they happen or as close as possible.
So these aren't just personal reminders, then. They have real legal weight. What are the hard and fast rules for taking these notes, especially since they could end up being scrutinized in court?
Exactly. They're official documents in a way. The source is crystal clear. Non-police info and personal comments should not be included. Absolutely not. Because if those notes get brought to court, they are subject to scrutiny. Lawyers can pick apart every single word, every abbreviation, every doodle in the margin. So it's crucial to ensure there are no impeachable discrepancies. That means the final formal report and notes must be consistent. Any contradiction, even a small one, could wreck the credibility of the report or the officer's testimony. It could sink a whole case. Interestingly, the source mentions that TCOA, that's the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement, says if all the information from your notes is accurately put into the formal report, the original notes can be destroyed, depending on agency policy, of course. But the big takeaway is every mark in those notes needs to be accurate, objective, and directly relevant. It's a professional record, not your personal diary.
Okay, so you're on a scene, maybe it's chaotic, information overload. What specific categories of detail does the source say you must capture in those notes to make sure you're building a complete, solid record? This sounds like a really useful checklist.
It really is a comprehensive checklist designed so nothing vital gets missed and the final report is rock solid. The source breaks it down really well, mostly following that 5 W's and 1 H structure. First, for persons, you have to identify everyone by their role, suspect, victim, witness. Get the correct spelling of their full name, their exact address, all phone numbers they have, home, work, cell, any known aliases, and what their involvement was. Then the basics. Sex, race, occupation, age, date of birth, and any ID numbers like driver's license, social security, passport. And then the critical description describes suspects and victims from head to toe. Race, sex, height, weight, hair, color and style, hat, face complexion, eyes, nose, mouth, shirt, pants, shoes, color and style. And don't forget distinguishing marks, tattoos, scars, limps, missing teeth, visible injuries. The goal is a clear and vivid word picture for anyone reading it later. Next. What? You need to note the specific type of offense, what property was involved, like that blue Schwinn bike or a Dell laptop, the means of transport used. Car, foot, which direction they went, any exact quotes or key statements people made, and any unusual actions or characteristics you observed. For when, precision is vital. Get the date and time the offense happened, when it was discovered, when it was reported to police, when evidence was found, when witnesses, victims were contacted, when arrests occurred. If you can't get an exact time, you have to figure out between what time the offense occurred. Like if a house was burgled during the day, it might be between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. on Tuesday. Pin down that time frame. Where? You need the exact location of offense and evidence. Use reference points, if you can, 10 feet north of the big oak tree, by the third cash register. Describe the type of area, residential street, business parking lot, open field, and note where everyone involved was in relation to the scene. For street addresses, a general number is okay, but officers should try to pinpoint the exact spot to help future investigations or link it to other calls there. Under why? You document anything suggesting a motive. Was it revenge? Drugs, money, an accident? This adds crucial context. And how? Describe the sequence. How did the offense happen? How did the suspect get in or approach? How did they leave? How were police notified? How did the officer approach? What did the scene and people look like on arrival? Reconstruct the event flow. The source also gives that great mnemonic for vehicles. See wine ball. See color. Top to bottom of two-tone. Y year. M, make model. B, body style, two-door SUV pickup. L, license plate, number, state, year. Plus, grab the VIN if you can, estimate the value, note any damage or unique features, and maybe insurance info. And for other property, get the manufacturer, model, name, number, serial number, cost or value, size, color, style, what it's used for, where it was found, and what happened to it, taken as evidence left with owner. It's an incredibly detailed approach, but it ensures the notes capture everything needed for a thorough, accurate, defensible report, nothing left to chance or memory.
Wow, that is exhaustive. So once those incredibly detailed notes are down, what's the next step to formalize someone's account, especially if their testimony is really central to the case?
Right. The next formal step, when it's needed, is to obtain written statement from witnesses or complainant. This basically turns their spoken account into a solid, signed document. The process is pretty defined. First, you record information and make notes during the interview, like we just discussed. Then you review notes and make corrections, making sure everything's clear and accurate before writing it up formally. Then you write type statement in person's own words. This is important. Use their phrasing as much as possible to keep it authentic. Finally, you have the person sign the statement, and crucially, they need to initial any changes or corrections corrections made on the document, showing they agree with the final version. These signed statements are then handled as per policy, maybe filed as evidence, maybe attached to the main report, but now you have a clear, signed, verifiable record of what they said. It turns a conversation into lasting evidence.
Okay, now we're getting into maybe one of the most talked about and maybe misunderstood parts of investigations, the Fifth Amendment, self-incrimination, and those famous Miranda warnings. When does an officer actually have to read someone their rights? We see it all the time in movies, but the reality seems a bit more specific.
It is very specific, and getting it right is absolutely critical. The source makes it really clear. Miranda warnings are not necessary until the suspect is subjected to custodial interrogation. It's not just about being asked questions. It's a specific two-part test, and both parts have to be true for Miranda to kick in. First part. The person has to be taken into custody or deprived of freedom by authorities in any significant way. Basically, would a reasonable person in their shoes feel free to just get up and leave? Whether someone's truly in custody can be fuzzy sometimes, and ultimately a judge might decide based on all the circumstances. Getting pulled over for speeding, usually not custody, handcuffed in the back of a patrol car, almost certainly custody. Second part, the individual is being interrogated or questioned about an offense. The questioning has to be about the actual crime they're suspected of. So if someone is free to leave, Miranda usually doesn't apply. Or if they're in custody but just being asked basic booking questions like name and address, still no Miranda needed for those. But if an interview situation changes and becomes custodial, maybe you decide they're not free to leave anymore and you plan to question them about the crime, then bam, you have to stop, read them their Miranda rights right then and there. It's a direct protection from the Fifth Amendment, stemming from that landmark Miranda v. Arizona case. A fundamental safeguard.
Okay, so once both those conditions are met, they're in custody. A and D being questioned about the crime. What are the exact rights they have to be told, word for word?
The exact wording is crucial for it to be valid, and officers often read it directly from a card to ensure accuracy. It goes like this. You have the right to remain silent and not make any statement at all, and any statement you make may be used against you at trial. Pretty clear. Anything you say can hurt you later. Quote, any statement you make may be used as evidence against you in court. Just reinforcing that first point. You have the right to have a lawyer present with you during questioning. Quote, if you are unable to employ a lawyer, you have the right to have a lawyer appointed to advise you prior to and during any questioning. This guarantees legal help, even if you can't afford it. And finally, you have the right to terminate the interview at any time. You can start talking and then decide to stop, and they have to respect that. Now, after reading those rights, it's not over. A voluntary waiver is needed. The officer has to ask two key follow-up questions. Do you understand these rights? And with those in mind, would you mind answering some questions? Department policy might tweak the exact wording of that second waiver question, but the point is the same. This confirms the person actually understood their rights before choosing to speak. It's not just a formality, it's about ensuring a knowing and voluntary waiver.
What happens if the person doesn't speak English well? Or maybe they're deaf or hard of hearing? How do you make sure they genuinely understand these critical rights for the waiver to be valid?
That's a really important point. In those cases, you absolutely have to bring in a qualified interpreter. The interpreter reads or signs the Miranda rights to the person in their language or modality. This is essential. Without genuine understanding, there's no way they can make a knowing and voluntary waiver of their rights. The specific procedures for getting and using interpreters would be dictated by department policy, making sure it's done correctly, respectfully, and leads to full comprehension.
Okay, so what does this mean in practice? What happens if someone is in custody, they've been read their rights, and they clearly state, I don't want to talk? Or maybe even more definitively, I want a lawyer.
That's a hard stop. A clear invocation of rights changes everything immediately. Once persons in custody indicate their right to remain silent, interrogations must cease. Full stop. You cannot keep questioning them about the offense. And if they ask for an attorney, the questioning has to stop until an attorney is present, or alternatively, until there is at least a 14-day break in Miranda custody. End quote. This 14-day rule came out of a Supreme Court case, Maryland v. Schatzer. It sets a clear boundary. It basically means that once someone lawyers up, the police have to back off completely for 2 weeks regarding that custodial interrogation. They can't try to reinitiate questioning about the crime during that time unless the suspect themselves reaches out first to talk to the police. It's a strong protection against badgering or pressuring someone after they've asked for legal help.
So Miranda is critical. But beyond those warnings, what about the broader legal requirements in Texas law? You mentioned CCP 38.21 and 38.22 for a statement to actually be admissible, to be used as evidence in court. Seems like there's more to it than just reading the rights.
You're absolutely right. Those articles in the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure add more layers of requirements for statements to be considered legally valid evidence. Under CCP 38.21, the bottom line is any statement must be freely and voluntarily made without compulsion or persuasion. No threats, no promises, no tricks that would make someone confess against their will. Then CCP 38.22 gets really specific about how statements are recorded, especially written and oral ones made during custodial interrogation. For written statements, they either have to be in the accused person's own handwriting, or if someone else writes it, the accused has to sign it in a language they understand. If they can't write, their mark needs to be witnessed by someone who is not a police officer for impartiality. And again, no custodial interrogations without Miranda warnings are allowed if the statement's going to be used against them. For oral statements, or even sign language statements made during that custodial interrogation, the rules are even stricter. They must be electronically recorded audio or video. And on that recording, before the statement begins, the person must be given the Miranda warnings again, and they have to knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive those rights also on the recording. The recording device has to work properly. The person operating it needs to be competent. The recording itself must be accurate and totally unaltered. All voices have to be identified. And finally, the defense attorney has to get a true and complete copy of all these recordings at least 20 days before any court proceeding. These recordings have to be kept safe until the whole case, including appeals, is completely finished. These incredibly strict rules are all designed to guarantee the statement was voluntary, accurately captured, and the whole process was transparent and fair, protecting rights and the integrity of the evidence.
Wow, that is incredibly detailed. Okay, another key legal concept mentioned is Brady information. What exactly is that, and why is it so crucial for officers to understand and document this stuff, even if it seems like it might weaken their own case?
Brady info is absolutely fundamental to a fair trial. It comes from a huge Supreme Court case, Brady v. Maryland, back in 63. It refers to info that is both favorable and material to the prosecution or defense. Material basically means evidence or facts that have a reasonable probability of affecting the case or trial. This is critical because the government, and that absolutely includes police, has a constitutional duty to turn this information over to the defense lawyers, even if it's exculpatory, meaning it suggests the defendant might not be guilty, or if it's impeachment material, meaning it could be used to challenge the credibility of a prosecution witness, maybe showing they lied before or have a grudge or some reason to be biased. The source highlights that law enforcement agencies shall submit to the ARS, the attorney representing the state, the prosecutor, a written statement confirming that all the required documents, items, and information they have that needs to be disclosed has been disclosed. And if they find more Brady material later on, they have to promptly disclose it too. This whole duty ensures due process, a fair fight in court. Withholding Brady info is a major violation of a defendant's rights. So yeah, officers have to be diligent about identifying and reporting all relevant facts, not just the ones that build their case. That includes their own field notes sometimes. It's a cornerstone of justice.
All right, so before you even start writing that formal report, you need to be crystal clear on who's who in the situation. Our source defines some key roles that are basic building blocks for police reports. Let's break down these terms, because sometimes the roles aren't as obvious as they seem.
Yeah, getting these roles right is fundamental for anyone reading the report to understand what's going on. The source gives clear definitions. A complainant is the person requesting an investigation or action, and they are usually a victim, so the person who dials 911 or comes to the station. A victim is defined specifically as the person injured by a crime. And remember, injured doesn't just mean physically hurt, it includes victims of property crimes too. Losing your stuff can be just as traumatic. A suspect is a person considered to be directly or indirectly connected with a crime, whether they did it themselves or planned it, the person being investigated. A witness is a person who saw the crime commission, part of it, or has relevant info. They provide information but weren't the victim or suspect, and a statement is simply a legal narrative description of events related to a crime. Now, where it gets nuanced, like you said, is how these roles apply in different situations. For example, if someone's arrested for DWI driving while intoxicated, or maybe public intoxication, the official victim is actually listed as the state of Texas because it's a crime against the public order. The complainant in that case is the arresting officer. The person who called 911 about the drunk driver might be the reporting party, but they aren't the legal complainant or victim, or say a shoplifting case at a store. The victim is the business itself. the complainant would be someone authorized to act for the business, like the store manager or loss prevention officer who reported it. For cases like runaways or missing persons, the person who is missing the subject is listed as the victim. The person who reported them missing, maybe their parent, is the complainant. And of course, sometimes the victim and the complainant are the same person. In that case, the source suggests using the term victim is often preferred. Getting these labels right just makes the whole report much clearer.
Okay, so that clarifies the players. But why go to all this trouble? Why do these reports even exist? What's their actual purpose beyond just, you know, logging that a call happened? What's the bigger picture here?
That's a great question, because they serve so many vital functions. Police reports have numerous official uses that make them absolutely foundational, not just for the case itself, but for the whole system. First, they are a permanent record of facts, a historical account that can be looked back on years, even decades later. Second, they allow for coordination of follow-up. Think about a complex case. Detectives, other shifts, maybe even other police departments need that report to pick up where the first officer left off without starting from scratch. Third, they form the basis for prosecution and defense. Lawyers on both sides rely heavily on these reports for evidence, timelines, witness details, everything. Fourth, believe it or not, they can factor into performance evaluations of officer, showing the quality and thoroughness of their work. Fifth, they provide critical statistical data. How else do we track crime trends, figure out where to put resources, or develop safety strategies? Agencies need that data. And finally, they serve as reference material for all sorts of things, training new recruits, academic research, internal reviews, not just paperwork. They're the bedrock for so much of what happens next in the justice system.
Makes sense. So what specific types of reports are we generally talking about? And once you have all the info gathered, how do you actually structure the narrative? Is there like a standard way to organize them?
The source lists the common ones you'd expect. Arrest reports, obviously. Incident information reports, which might be for non-criminal things or just initial info. Offense reports for specific crimes. Crash reports for car accidents. And supplemental reports, which are used to add new information to a case that's already been reported. As for how they're organized, there are two main approaches for the narrative part. One is chronological. That means arrangement of info in the order of occurrence. You basically tell the story from beginning to end, following the sequence of events as they happened. The source says this is generally the easiest way to write a report and are easier to understand for the reader, especially for straightforward cases. It reads like a story. The other way is categorical. This is an arrangement of information by category. So you might group things by witness. Here's everything witness A said, then here's everything witness B said. Or by location, or by evidence type. In this style, the overall story might be organized into paragraphs of what each witness suspect said. While each person's account may be chronological within its section, the reader has to kind of read all accounts to figure out the overall chronological storyline, end quote. The source notes this can get very repetitive and confusing for complex cases with lots of witnesses. But maybe for simpler cases or cases with really conflicting stories, it could work by laying out each perspective separately. Often, though, the specific police department's policy will dictate which method they prefer. Clarity is always the main goal.
So, regardless of the report type or how you choose to organize it, what are the absolute non-negotiable must-have pieces of information for any police report to actually be useful? The core pillars, maybe.
Yeah. There are three essential pillars that every effective police report has to include, no matter the format. Number one, identification of the involved persons, vehicles, etc. This covers the who and what, making sure every person, car, or piece of property is clearly identified with all those details we talked about earlier. Number two, narrative description of the offense or incident. This is the main story, the detailed what happened, told factually, clearly, without bias, the core account of the event. And number three, elements of the offense or probable cause. This is crucial. The report needs to clearly show the legal justification for any action taken. It means laying out the facts that meet the legal definition of the crime, providing the probable cause needed for an arrest or charges. These three things are absolutely fundamental. They ensure the report isn't just a random collection of facts, but a coherent, legally sound document that actually does its job.
Okay, this is where it gets really practical. Our source lays out 8 criteria for a good police report. This feels like the real checklist for quality, turning all that careful information gathering into a document that's actually effective and useful. Let's break these down, because honestly, these probably apply to writing a clear email, too.
They probably do. These 8 criteria really are the gold standard. They ensure the report is clear, reliable, and useful for anyone who needs to read it, prosecutor, judge, another officer, whoever. First, and you could argue it's the most important. 1. accurate, defined as exact conformity to the truth. This is non-negotiable. The source warns that reporting errors cause false facts to become the legal truth. Think about that. Huge consequences. Accuracy comes from three places: testimony from others, evidence, and the officer's own personal observation, and the advice. Listen carefully and write it down. Do not trust memory. Our brains just aren't reliable recorders, especially under pressure. Accuracy also means being fair. Report all sides and accounts. Even if various witnesses varied recalls, you still have to describe each account. You don't just leave out the story that doesn't fit, but you can document their affiliations that may explain the contradiction, or note the context that might explain the differing account. Maybe someone only saw part of it, or maybe they were impaired somehow. You'd note the facts supporting that observation. Second criterion, 2, complete. Simple enough. All facts included and form fields filled. Get good contact info for everyone. Note down any aliases. Use the right codes for roles: suspect, witness, victim, complainant. Missing one key detail can stall everything. 3, concise. This means no unnecessary details or wordiness. You want to convey the facts clearly, but be brief and to the point. The tricky part is not to sacrifice clarity, completeness, or accuracy to be concise. The source has some funny examples of being too concise, like an officer writing, "The guy was all over the road. I had to swerve several times before I hit him." Yikes. Really shows the danger, right? You want brevity, but clarity is king. It also notes you don't need a play-by-play of every single routine action, but some things do need more detail: documenting deception, getting a confession, explaining a use of force incident. Those need context. 4, clear. The report must have only one interpretation, no matter who reads it. The goal is to inform, not entertain. It's a one-way info exchange, usually written in first person and past tense. I observed, I spoke with. Use last names mostly, unless maybe it's a family dispute where everyone has the same last name, then first and last might be clearer. And critically, do not use role terms and numbers for people involved in the narrative itself, like suspect one or victim two. Identify them by name, then use their last name. Avoids confusion. 5, and this is huge, 5, objective, meaning report without bias or distortion. You have to describe facts, don't translate them. Translations, the source says, are your own opinions, generalizations, or judgments creeping in, making the writing vague. Avoid generalizations like assaulted, resisted, attacked. Those are legal conclusions you need to support with facts. Avoid judgments like obscene, strange, typical. Those are subjective. The examples here are great. Instead of writing, "Wilson attacked his girlfriend, causing her bodily injury," which is a conclusion, an objective report says, "Wilson punched his girlfriend, Mary Smith, in the head at least 5 times. I observed that Smith had 2 swollen black eyes, a split lip, and a broken tooth." See the difference? Actions and observable results, not just a label. Another one. Instead of, "When I tried to handcuff Barnes, he resisted and fought with me," which is vague. Describe it. "Barnes was standing facing away. As upon the cuff on his right hand, he pulled his left arm free, spun, and swung his left elbow toward my head. I dodged, delivered a knee strike. Barnes fell. Jones and I wrestled him. I then handcuffed him." See? Precise actions, no ambiguity. The goal is to lead the reader to the obvious conclusion through articulable facts, not your interpretation. Instead of, "The suspect tested the fence," that's guessing intent, describe the action. "The suspect walked to the fence, grabbed it, shook it, put one foot into a link, both hands on links above his head, leaned back, holding on to and stretching the fence." Let the reader conclude he was trying to climb based on those facts. The source even lists specific shortcut words to avoid because they are conclusions, not facts. "Very intoxicated," instead describe slurred speech, swaying, etc. "Uncooperative," instead describe how, "I asked 3 times for his license, he interrupted me 5 times." "Vulgar language," instead quote it or describe it, "He yelled the F word 7 times." Altercation. Instead, describe the actions: 2 men wrestling and punching. Gun. Instead, be specific: black semi-auto pistol, silver .38 revolver. Agitated. Instead, describe the behavior: repeatedly ran hands through hair, paste, clenched fists. It's a constant discipline to stay objective. The last 3 criteria are more basic, but still vital. 6, legible. It needs to be readable, obviously. 7, grammatically correct. Poor grammar can create confusion. 8, correct spelling. Professionalism and clarity demand it. Stick to these 8 and you've got a solid, professional, useful report.
Okay, what about those really sensitive cases? Like involving victims of sexual assault or family violence. There are special rules about confidentiality and naming, right? What's CCP 58 about?
Yes, Article 58 of the Code of Criminal Procedure provides a really important protection. It says, a victim may choose a pseudonym to designate his or her identity in all public files and records concerning the offense. This right applies to victims of stalking, trafficking, sexual assault, family violence, child abduction, serious sensitive crimes. It lets them use a fake name in public records to protect their privacy and safety during the legal process. How exactly that pseudonym is documented and used is up to agency policy, but knowingly releasing that confidential info by a public servant is actually a Class C misdemeanor. It underscores how seriously victim privacy is taken in these situations.
And just generally, when naming people in the report narrative, the source contrasts writing, I stopped the speeding violator, versus maybe I stopped the violator later identified as Tim Johnson. What's the clearest way to do that to avoid confusing the reader?
Clarity is definitely the goal. The source points out that jumping from the violator to Mr. Johnson, without connecting them, can make it sound like maybe two different people were involved. A small point, but potentially confusing. So the preferred ways are either using that later identified phrase, like you mentioned, or just clearly describing when and how you identified the person within the narrative flow. So, I stopped the violator, later identified as Tim Johnson, works. Or even better, often, is weaving it in. I stopped the speeding violator. I made contact with the driver. He stated he was late for work. I then obtained his Texas driver's license, which identified him as Tim Johnson, Wilmanti, ON1275. That integrates the ID smoothly, leaving no doubt who Mr. Johnson is. It just makes for a cleaner, less ambiguous read.
And how precise do you need to be with times and locations? Is sometime last night good enough, or do you need to dig deeper?
Precision is always the aim, but you have to be realistic too. If you truly can't get an exact date and time, maybe a burglary happened while someone was away all weekend, then you absolutely need to figure out between what time the offense occurred.
Right.
Ask, when did you leave? When do you get back and notice? The report would then state the time frame clearly. The offense occurred between 5 p.m. Friday and 8 p.m. Sunday. If it's overnight, maybe between 10 p.m. Monday and 7 a.m. Tuesday. Establish the window. For locations, if it's on a public street, yeah, a basic address like 123 Main Street is the starting point. But officers are really encouraged to attempt to determine the exact location within that address block. Why? To assist investigators and associate the offense in case of future calls to the same location. So maybe 123 Main Street near the fire hydrant in front of the residence or in the alley behind 123 Main Street. That extra precision helps with crime mapping, follow-up, and just knowing exactly where things happened.
Okay, so you've gathered all this incredibly detailed information, you know, the 8 rules for making it good. Now, how do you actually put it all together? How do you structure the written report itself? Our source breaks it down into 3 main sections, like a blueprint.
Exactly. These 3 sections give the report a logical flow, guiding the reader through the information smoothly and making sure all the key parts are covered. First up is the synopsis. Think of this as the case summary or the introduction. Its main job is to quickly prep the reader for the detailed story that's coming in the narrative section. The source notes it's often the part used to disseminate information to the media because basic police activity is generally public record. So the synopsis should summarize the key events and the final disposition. What happened briefly and what was the outcome? Arrest made. Suspect gone. Just a report taken. But, critically important, no names, specific addresses, or information should be in the public-facing synopsis, especially sensitive victim details or info that could compromise the case. The source even gives a handy synopsis formula. When, where, how police got involved, plus what crime happened, plus case outcome, arrest, fled, report taken. So, an example might be, on July 21st, officers responded to a reported robbery in the 1000 block of Main St. Patrol officers located and arrested the suspect nearby. Or, on June 1st, officers took a report of an aggravated robbery in the 1200 block of Oak Ave. The suspect fled before arrival. An offense report was completed. Quick, high level, just the essentials for a quick read. Second section, the narrative. This is the absolute heart of the report. It contains the concise details of what happened. It's almost always told in chronological order of what happened, laying out the sequence of events as they occurred. A key piece of advice here is to set the stage, meaning you locate and introduce the people, places, and things before detailing them. Don't just jump into actions. Introduce the scene, introduce the players, and describe things systematically. Locate from near to far, far to near, but do not skip around. Keep it logical. The narrative should also strictly avoid tangents or irrelevant details. Keep it focused on the actual incident or crime. And the third section is the supplemental. This is where you put all the extra background details or document the administrative duties that are important but would kind of clutter up the main story if you put them in the narrative. This includes things like the evidence final details, packaging, submission, maybe listing specific evidence logs or forms used. It includes procedural matters, like noting that you obtained written statements. It can include dollar amounts, non-offense identifying, for property damage or stolen item values, and any other clarifying info that would have distracted from the narrative's clarity. It's the place for important supporting details that don't fit neatly into the main timeline.
Okay, so those are the sections within the report. But are there different ways to organize the entire report, especially that main narrative part? The source mentions two main models.
Yeah, there are two overarching models that guide how you structure that narrative, and the best choice often depends on how complex the case is. The first is the detective model. With this approach, the report is written as you experienced the call. It basically follows your investigation chronologically from your perspective as the officer, so it might read, I arrived on scene, then I spoke to witness A, then I checked the building, then I spoke to witness B. The source says this works well for simple cases and differing accounts of what happened because it clearly shows your steps. But it can be hard to follow and repetitive in cases with multiple coherent witness accounts. The reader might have to mentally jump around to piece together the actual timeline of the incident itself based on when you talk to different people. The second model is the timeline model. This is a really effective approach, actually developed by a guy named John Bowden. Here, the events in the case are organized on a timeline, and the report is written chronologically from the coherent events of the timeline. This means you structure the narrative around the sequence of events as they actually happened, regardless of when you, the officer, found out about them. This model can easily adapt to conflicting and multiple witness accounts because the backbone of the story is the objective timeline of the incident itself, not just the order you gathered info.
So for someone actually writing the report, how do you choose? Which model is generally better, or can you mix them?
The general guidance from the source leans towards the timeline approach. Chronological timeline reports are usually the easiest way to write a report and are easier to understand for the reader. Our brains just naturally follow stories told in order. The strong recommendation is, whatever model is used, the case facts should be organized into a timeline before deciding on the model to use. So figure out the actual sequence of events first, maybe jot it down, then decide how best to write it up. Can you combine them? Sure, sometimes. Maybe the main narrative is chronological, timeline model, but a specific part detailing your actions fits the detective model. But the key advice is, if the detective model would require you to skip around the timeline a lot, then it may not be the best format for the report. The ultimate goal is always clarity and ease of understanding for the reader. The timeline model often wins out for complex cases precisely because it organizes the events logically, providing a clear, easy-to-follow story, which makes it much easier for whoever reads it later to grasp what actually happened.
You know, when you boil it all down, all this careful reporting, all the detailed questions, the legal stuff, it all comes back to one really basic skill. Observation, just noticing things. How does the source emphasize just how critical it is to truly see and hear and sense what's going on around you?
It puts it right up front. An officer's ability to be descriptive in field notes and reports is based on their observation skills. Simple as that. And it's not just about looking. It emphasizes using all five senses, sight, hearing, touch, taste, and smell are used in observation. Did you smell alcohol? Hear glass breaking? Feel a door was forced open? These skills are described as perishable and must be programmed and practiced to stay sharp.
Yeah.
You have to consciously work at being observant, actively taking in details, not just passively seeing things. It's about engaging your senses and processing that input immediately, because those details are the raw ingredients for everything else.
And once you have observed all that, how do you translate it effectively into writing? How do you create that clear and vivid word picture so someone reading the report feels like they understand exactly what you saw, heard, or smelled?
Descriptive writing is all about specifics, painting that picture with words. For people, the advice is systematic. Describe them, beginning with race, sex, and age, and continuing with a head-to-toe description. Don't forget those distinguishing marks, tattoos, scars, limps, missing teeth, unique jewelry. Also, note their manner of speaking or walking, accents, their movements, or the things they are carrying. Build a unique image. For places, describe them beginning at one point, then proceeding in one consistent direction, such as left to right or top to bottom, systematically so you don't miss anything. Literally, paint a picture of the place using words, noting doors, windows, furniture, damage, evidence locations. Maybe describe a room starting at the door and moving clockwise. For things, especially vehicles, use that symbol method. Color, year, make, model, body, license. For other property, get the manufacturer, model, serial number, value, size, color, style, its use, any distinguishing marks. Always look for the unique identifier, a cracked phone screen, a custom rims on a car, a specific sticker on a backpack. The more specific you are, the better the reader understands, and the easier it is to identify that specific item later.
We talked about chronological reporting for the final document, but the source also brings up using a timeline as more of an active investigative tool, not just the report structure. What's the difference there, and why is thinking in terms of a timeline so powerful for an investigator, or really for anyone trying to solve a puzzle?
Yeah, this is a really insightful distinction. Using a chronological structure for the final report is about clear presentation after the fact. Using a timeline as an investigative tool is about organizing information as you gather it to help you, the investigator, make sense of it all. The source advises, stay organized, build a timeline for important case events, the person you are interviewing, and then for the whole incident you are investigating. So, you might map out witness A's story on a timeline, then do the same for witness B. Then you create a master timeline for the whole incident, trying to slot everyone's actions and statements into the correct sequence. Interestingly, it notes that the standard horizontal timeline isn't great for taking detailed notes in the field hard to write sideways in a small notebook. Instead, it suggests a vertical plotting of info will be easier to follow and allow for more details. Imagine columns for each person plotted against time going down the page. The real power of using this timeline during investigation is how it helps you note any gaps and missing info. Where are the holes in the story? It helps you look for signs of credibility and/or discrepancies by comparing timelines. Does witness A's account match witness B's timing? How does their story fit the overall known sequence? And crucially, it helps you commit them to a story so later cleanup efforts will not work for court. Once you have their detailed timeline locked down in your notes, if they try to change their story later, you can use your timeline to gently, or maybe not so gently, point out the inconsistencies. It gives them a chance to clarify or correct, but prevents them from just rewriting history later. It's a really proactive way to build a solid, verifiable understanding of what happened. A powerful tool for getting to the truth in any complex situation, really. #outro.
Wow. So we've really gone deep today into what it actually takes to gather information effectively and report it accurately. We started with that key difference between interviewing and interrogation, realizing how the approach has to change depending on who you're talking to. Then we walked through turning that raw emotional outburst, he stole my bike, as for it, into a solid detailed case using those systematic who, what, where, when, why, and how questions. We saw the power of asking the right kind of question from that toolkit of five types, every word counts.
Yeah, and then we got into the nitty-gritty of field notes, the absolute bedrock, and the critical legal side. Miranda warnings, when they apply, what makes a statement admissible in court? All those rules from the CCP. And finally, those eight rigorous standards for writing a good report focusing on accuracy, objectivity, clarity, completeness. We saw how sharp observation skills are the foundation for it all, and how that timeline mindset is more than just structure. It's a dynamic tool for sorting out complex facts. This whole deep dive really drives home how essential these skills are, not just for police, but really in any field where you need precision and clarity and you need to separate fact from fiction.
It really does.
Yeah.
And it leaves us with a pretty interesting question, I think, for everyone listening. If even something relatively simple like that stolen bike needs such a complex, structured approach just to establish the basic facts, what does that suggest about all the information we swim in every single day? News reports, things people tell us. What does it say about the importance of us asking those same critical who, what, where, when, why, and how questions ourselves instead of just, you know, accepting the first thing we hear?
Exactly. Think about looking for those common threads of truth that often emerge, even when different people remember things differently. And think about that skill of leading someone or even leading yourself to an obvious conclusion based on articulable facts, not just assumptions or gut feelings. These principles, thoroughness, seeking clarity, verifying details, they aren't just for detectives. They're tools for all of us. Tools for seeking a deeper, more reliable understanding of pretty much everything around us.
Keep asking those questions. Keep digging for clarity. We really hope this deep dive gave you a new appreciation for the incredibly detailed work that goes into being truly well-informed. And maybe, just maybe, it gave you a few new tools for your own everyday investigations.